like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Dr. Kathleen Schnarz-Uvino, a professor of biology and ecology at the University of Jamestown. Dr. Uvino, more commonly known as Dr. Kit, oversees the Tree Swallow Project, which is set in two countries, in Jamestown, where the campus is located, and in Churchill, Manitoba. The project aims to study various aspects of this migratory bird, which is an aerial insectivore, meaning it munches on hordes of mosquitoes or other biting insects each day. The tree swallow population has been declining for decades, apparently at a significant rate, at least in some areas. Among the distinctive traits of these birds is that they practically beckon those who study them and that they easily adapt to nest boxes built and installed by those researchers. In fact, earlier this summer on a family trip to Churchill, we met Dr. Kit and had a chance to observe her and one of her students as they were tending to a nest box, pulling the tree swallows out, weighing them, logging info, and then releasing them. Dr. Kit joked about how low-tech the operation was, but it was fascinating to see part of this sort of study unfold before our eyes. We'll find out more about this tree swallow project, how its findings may differ from other studies looking at these birds, the implications of this research, and more when I speak with Dr. Kit in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later on in the program, I'll speak with Dr. Val Beasley, a professor of veterinary wildlife and ecological toxicology sciences at Pennsylvania State University. We'll discuss how algae and water can poison dogs, like those dogs who died in recent days in North Carolina, Austin, Georgia, and elsewhere, and precautions dog owners can take to avoid placing their animals at risk. Also, in the Comedy Corner later on, we'll play you something brand new from Talking Animals' favorite Jim Gaffigan, whose new stand-up special, Quality Time, started streaming on Amazon Prime on Friday. Right now, though, let's get to Dr. Kit with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Dr. Kit on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dr. Kit.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you today?
I'm really well, and I appreciate you joining me on Talking Animals today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You bet. So, of course, we'll delve into the Tree Swallow Project in a moment, but first I'd like to learn a little bit more about you. Even by the stands of a college professor, you have a slew of degrees, which may suggest heading down one academic or professional path and then maybe veering off into at least one other path, at least early on. Does that observation hold up?
Oh, absolutely. I have spent almost 20 years in Manhattan working for eventually Time Warner Turner, and I had an opportunity for an early package, and that's when I went back to school to get my biology graduate degree.
Yeah, I mean, most of the degrees are biology, but then there's early on there's a vet tech degree, so I thought, well, maybe at one point you were thinking you'd head down that path, and then there's also a master's in computer science, so it's quite a mix.
Yes, when I went to work in Manhattan, I ended up in the computer department, and I excelled in it, but I really didn't like computers. And then I felt like I should legitimize myself by getting a degree, so I went back to school and got my master's in computer science.
Yeah, this is definitely an interesting path. So just, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I'd just be curious to know what it was you were doing in the Time Warner world before you plunged into academia.
When I left, I was director of technology for Time Warner, and I was running the technological needs for media sales and marketing.
So very tech-oriented, yet you just said you didn't really like computers. So that's it. That may or may not give us some insight as to why you switched gears.
Well, yes, I was going to say, I went into Manhattan because I got divorced and I had a 2-month-old infant and he liked to eat. So
I see. There were bills to pay.
Yes, sir.
I gotcha. As you did get into the academic world, what have tended to be your chief areas of interest in terms of research?
Well, I initially started doing research on the Colorado potato beetle and the evolution of resistance to certain insecticides, and that's what my dissertation is in. But at the same time, concurrent with that, I took a biostatistics course from Dr. Rockwell from City University, and he was involved with this Hudson Bay project, which researches many different aspects of coastal subarctic tundra. They study polar bears and eiders and yellow warblers and savanna sparrows. Vegetation is a big part of it as well. So he asked me if I'd be interested in coming up for one summer. So I said yes. I jumped at the chance. And I've always loved birds since my undergraduate ornithology class. So I eventually wondered why no one had done any publishing on the tree swallows of Churchill. They've been in the record forever, but there weren't any formalized research projects.
You went up there at that doctor's beckoning and looked around or helped out, but then gravitated towards the tree swallows, or were you kind of doing that as part of the range of things early on?
Well, I just started banding the tree swallows 4 years ago, but we've always had tree swallow nest boxes out at the remote camp, and I still am involved with many of the projects with the remote camp. But, yeah, the tree swallow projects, I moved into town in a formal way, in a big way, as you saw, so that we could access them easily. Out at the remote camp, there's not a lot of trees, and it's very difficult to get around to that many nest boxes.
I see. So the idea was to relocate from where a lot of the core Hudson Bay stuff was taking place to areas that were more conducive to tree swallows and nest boxes.
Correct. I still have about 20 nest boxes out at camp, and the students, the researchers that are out there, they monitor those for me, and I'll go out there and ban them. But I have the bulk of the nest boxes around the Cape Churchill area.
And so, although you said that, you know, you were always interested in birds since the first ornithology class, but what about tree swallows in particular grabbed you early on?
Oh, getting eaten alive by a million mosquitoes and other biting flies, the bulldogs, the black flies. Tree swallows are part of this group of birds, this clade of aerial insectivores, that are being really stressed out, and their populations are declining. But a lot of that has to do with studies in the Northeast and agricultural areas. Now, Churchill and Jamestown are not in the Northeast. They're in the mid-continent, one being North Dakota, one being northern Manitoba. And they are not, the Churchill area is not an agricultural area. So we don't have to worry up there about any herbicides or pesticides, insecticides. None of that is really used on any measurable scale.
So let's back up a little bit for folks listening who may not be all that familiar with Churchill or may have heard of it only sort of in references to polar bears. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about Churchill, the area, and what does go on there in addition to the Tree Swallow Project, which we'll, of course, get into in more detail in a moment.
Sure. So Churchill is a remote town. It's not connected by road to the outside world, so you must fly in or you must take a train. It's 2 days on the train from Winnipeg, 1 day from Thompson. But that train ride really gives you an overview of the changing landscapes as you go from the Great Plains through the deciduous forest, then the boreal forest, and then finally you're in the subarctic tundra. Once you get to Churchill, the population year-round is about 800. It absolutely blossoms during bear season, as you said, and recently they're having a beluga whale season, and they have a lot of visitors for that experience. Churchill itself has a lot of mom-and-pop shops. There's no big-name stores there besides the Northern Supermarket and Home Hardware. So it has a lot of appeal for being remote. There's a lot of interest by the local people into what you are doing, and when I hold workshops every May, the townspeople really come out, and they're very supportive, and they ask questions, and, you know, if they see us on the road checking things out, they'll stop and chat with us. Very friendly community, lots of good science going on there, and there's also the Churchill Northern Study Center, which is outside of town, but still accessible by road. You can drive there, and they have a lot of researchers working out there, and this year we got to actually band some of the tree swallows. They have 25 boxes out there. And we got to ban some of the tree swallow nestlings, which was exciting. So we're hoping that will continue.
Yeah, and I have to say, just being only in Churchill for a few days, so this might be sort of either glib or a cliche or worse, but it does seem like just kind of hanging out there for a few days, I guess partly because it is a very small town, and it is, as you say, kind of like remote and insular, but there's very much a, for anybody that ever watched over the years and then maybe later in reruns, Northern Exposure, it really kind of put me in the mind of that, and only in the best way possible, and everybody seems super friendly, super interested in what you're doing, like you say. I mean, in terms of the research you're doing, not surprising to me at all that the people would come to lectures or come help out or just acknowledge you. It just seemed like there's there's a particular type of person probably that can and does live there and can flourish in what can be pretty harsh conditions, obviously, and not to mention that even in the best of weather, you're still pretty remote. So it seems like there's a certain kind of person that lives there, and we thought everybody was just fantastic.
Absolutely. I have many, many good friends in Churchill, and we stay in touch year-round, and we visit each other throughout the year as well.
Back to our tree swallow friends. So talked a little bit about them. They're insectivores, and for people like some of us who are particularly vulnerable to mosquito bites, they're our friends because that's what they munch on, is, as you've noted, the mosquitoes and other biting bugs. What else are distinctive about tree swallows?
Well, I was going to say they are considered a model organism because, as you said in your opening, they readily adapt to nest boxes. Prior to a nest box installation, you would have to walk through the forest looking for secondary cavities that were built, made by some other organism, and then the tree swallow will use it if, it's available. But that's really labor-intensive. Having the nest boxes and their willingness to adapt to them, is a major plus, and it was confirmed that tree swallows will readily adapt through the use of the bluebird trail. Now, the bluebird trails were put up in response to the declining bluebirds, and they were just a trail of nest boxes that we thought were for bluebirds, and as it turns out, the tree swallows were nesting in them as well. So, anyone who wanted to study tree swallows was like, well, we can do the nest boxes and the tree swallows will adapt to them.
Yeah, so another way of putting that too is that tree swallows do need, and especially when it comes to nesting, require like cavities, like holes in trees or other things, but they're not keen on creating those cavities or maybe aren't all that capable in most cases. So they're looking for cavities that either nature created or some other critter, bird, or whatever created, and then they kind of move in.
Absolutely. And in every study that I'm aware of, the limiting factor on tree swallow reproductive output is the nest site. So, the theory at this point is that the more nest boxes you build, the more tree swallows you'll have.
Oh, wow. So whatever, let's say, since we're talking about Churchill, so let's say whatever the population in Churchill is of tree swallows, as you've added more boxes, the population of tree swallows has grown correspondingly?
Well, I can't do a population estimate because I only have the 4 years of data, but what I can tell you is as far as the net number of nests, last year we had 40-something nests. This year we had 93. So I didn't increase the number of boxes from last year. I stabilized it last year at 267.
So there's 267 total, but you bumped. Sorry, where did we get the 40 to 93? I guess I missed that part.
That was from last year's nests. We had about 42 or 43 nests.
Oh, I see. We're contrasting nests from actual boxes.
Right.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, so that's really interesting because did you want to get to a certain number of boxes because it would give you more significant or reliable data?
Yes, there is strength in the number of boxes. But also, Dave Winkler, who is out of Cornell, he is like the tree swallow king, and he has over about 400 boxes on his site. I have no intention of getting to 400 boxes. I'm very happy with what I have. Simply, it's a manual process, and right now we can handle checking all these boxes, and I think we're at the limit right now for, two or three people for the season.
Well, I want to ask a few more questions about that, but let me just let folks know this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Kathleen Schnarr-Zuvino, also known as Dr. Kit, a professor of biology and ecology at the University of Jamestown. She oversees the Tree Swallow Project, which is carried out in both Jamestown and Churchill, Manitoba. If you'd like to ask Dr. Kit a question or offer a comment, please call 813 813- 888-239-9663. Email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. So you're 4 years into the Tree Swallow Project?
Yes.
Is there something, well, actually, to put it the other way, beyond just getting an idea about the population and how stable or not or declining it may be, what are the other key things that you're looking to find from this research?
Well, we've noticed some unique behaviors, strange behaviors. We have an adult female that's feeding an incubating adult female at a nest box. And when, you know, that happens sometimes, but not, we're not quite sure, are they related? Why is this happening? Did the female on the outside who's doing the feeding, did she dump some eggs in the nest and is making sure her eggs get, you know, cared for? So we're not quite sure on the why, and that is where the next step will go. I'm going to start installing cameras so we can maybe figure out some of these behaviors. We also, one of the top predators for the tree swallow nest, whether it's the eggs or the young, are snakes. And we don't have snakes in Churchill. So we've got an entirely different group of predators up there. One of the most common is going to be the short-tailed weasel. And we did observe a weasel with its five young trying to cross the main highway in Churchill, and about 20 tree swallows were mobbing it, diving at it. And it was kind of cool to watch these weasels basically crawling on their belly across the road.
And so were the weasels thinking about or even capable of getting up into a nest box?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yes, it's especially the young. So, yes, then that's another aspect. I will be putting in predator guards for weasels. In town, we have the house sparrow, which is the number one predator. So we've put in predator guards to discourage house sparrows to some degree of success. But the weasels, they'll wipe out a nest, and it was a perplexing problem where I would check a nest and there would be six eggs, and you'd go back the next day and there's no egg.
Right, and I should let folks know listening that just to get more of a visual of why at least the weasel thing seems surprising to me is that these nest boxes, at least the ones I've seen, are way up off the ground, either on a pole or in some cases maybe on a tree or a structure, but they're way up off the ground. And if they're on a pole especially, it's hard for me to imagine how a weasel would even get access.
Oh, they'll climb the pole.
Yeah, apparently so. Yeah. No, but it's just hard to picture that. It's like, wow, those are one set of determined weasels if they're climbing a big pole as high as some of these that I saw there.
Yes, yes. And we've also, I had a red squirrel in a couple of my nest boxes, so we've put predator guards on to stop them from going in. They don't necessarily destroy the tree swallow nest. They can go into an empty box, but they make it their nest. So we have to avoid that situation.
Wow, there's a lot of opportunists roaming around in this world, it seems like. And including, like, one of the predators you said is another sparrow?
Yes, the house sparrow,
yeah.
Which is an invasive species in North America, but it has adapted well. It doesn't migrate in Churchill. They overwinter. The port building itself provides a refuge for the house sparrows, so they get some degree of warmth and food there all winter. They will nest in the roofs of houses and, you know, in the awnings. They're very, very successful. I wish the tree swallows were as clever.
Yeah.
Or as bold.
They're being outwitted, it sounds like, sometimes by their sort of brethren, I guess. But so, Dr. Kitt, at what point after you first went up at that doctor or mentor professor's invitation, at what point, once you kind of launched the Tree Swallow Project in Churchill, did you launch the counterpart that happens in Jamestown?
So I did them concurrently.
Okay.
So when I was in Jamestown, I was actually obviously a late graduate, and I got the job in Jamestown on my way to Churchill, so for the season.
Oh.
And I was installing boxes there, so when I came back that September and started in Jamestown, I installed the boxes in North Dakota, so that the following spring was year one for both sites.
Okay, so they have been on a totally parallel path.
Yes.
Yeah. And are you finding different results from the nest boxes and the birds there, Churchill, as opposed to Jamestown?
Well, we're finding that there's less occupancy in Jamestown, North Dakota, But that I'm not the only one who has nest boxes. A lot of private houses will put up two or three nest boxes, and there are other people who have nest boxes. So it just may be a matter of, you know, competition, a lot of nest sites. There's also agriculture around Jamestown, North Dakota.
So, and that gets us back to the insecticides and other things, you mean? Or
yes. And even though people think there's a lot of mosquitoes here, as you know, you've not seen any cloud of mosquitoes till you've gone to the tundra.
Yeah, no, seeing people, times I was amongst them, with netting, sometimes full-body netting, you think, oh, my God, is that really required? But when you're out there, it's like, yes, it is. Yes,
yeah.
Especially
yeah.
If you're particularly one of those people that mosquitoes really gravitate towards. So what is the, in terms of the population that I mentioned and you've since mentioned also, and it is declining, is that what some of your results are showing? And how would you contrast those with other studies that other researchers are doing that I guess at least partly is affected by geography?
Yes, we realize, I mean, one of the gaps in the knowledge base is that most of the tree swallow studies come from the Northeast, which is also heavily agricultural. So having, you know, these studies, these sites in the mid-continent, it's going to give us a different geographical aspect, but also having the site in Churchill, it's pristine. You know, Churchill may serve as a refugia for tree swallows and other aerial insectivores because of the plentiful food abundance, you know, and the lack of chemicals. So
yeah.
What they're eating not poisonous mosquitoes.
Right. So that's how that actually works. So in areas where there is agriculture and therefore there are insecticides being used, they're actually getting it through the mosquitoes or other bugs that they're consuming.
Yeah, exactly. It's a twofold. Number one, we're reducing the amount of food available to them. And number two, some of the food that they're eating is going to have some residue of the chemical.
I see. And that really does lead to a measurable decline in their population over time. Yeah. So is it really then, if it's near agriculture, that's where we're seeing a more precipitous decline? And if it's not, like in Churchill, are you still seeing some decline, or is it pretty much holding steady because it's not really?
We have no population estimate for Churchill.
Okay.
The first bird list kept in Manitoba was kept in Churchill in 1619 by Jens Munk. And he was an explorer who was slowly starving to death, him and his crew. And they documented the birds as they returned in the spring, largely because they were eating them. And
oh.
The tree swallows were on the list. So, you know, but no one has formally studied them and done a population estimate. And I believe it's largely because there's so much other research. You know, polar bears are sexy. Beluga whales are sexy. Tree swallows, everybody does tree swallows. You know, they weren't. I don't think it had the appeal of some of the other large fauna that is in Churchill.
Yeah, but it sounds like from what you've alluded to, there are a number of other tree swallow projects or research projects taking place elsewhere. And have those been in effect for some time?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They have decadal information. So this is going on decades and decades
okay.
of their research.
So yours is really kind of a young upstart against that backdrop.
Yes.
Yeah. But are those researchers, what do they say when they see at least the initial results that you're showing? Because, again, I don't know if there's other things that are distinctly different, but clearly, I guess, the fact that there's no insecticides and therefore no impact from that on the population. Are there other things that your results have reflected that have prompted those folks to take notice of your study in that way?
Well, one thing, again, David Winkler from Cornell, he's been very, very supportive. I've discussed some of the results with him. You know, and we're all waiting for the 5 years of data because then we can actually publish something.
Mm.
But one of the questions that I'm hoping I'll be able to address is if the tree swallows in Churchill are of a slightly smaller size, a smaller body size. We're not sure, but some of the observers, some bird watchers, who also watch tree swallows in southern Manitoba and in North Dakota, they just had a feeling, you know, and they asked me. They said, do you know if the size is different? I said, I really don't know. Well, you know, I'm measuring the weight, but we don't know if they're significantly different. So that's one of the questions that I'm looking for.
Okay.
The other thing is, if you hatch in Churchill, you have better than a 95% chance of fledging. And I think that's a very high. The third aspect is in many bird studies, you get, you know, passerines, you get less than a 5% recapture rate. And a recapture is when you handle a bird for the second or subsequent time. The first time you handle a bird, you band it, and you record that. The next time you encounter that bird, you know where you banded it, so you have that information. As I said, the recapture rate for most studies, less than 5%.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting about 30% recapture rate in Churchill.
Oh, wow.
So they're coming back. They like it. You know, they like Churchill in a big way, and they're healthy enough that they come back. So that's a good thing.
And we're given the very harsh conditions of Churchill for part of the year. Where do the tree swallows go when they do flee the area?
Well, like most smart people, they go south. No, I'm
yeah.
kidding. So they go down to Texas, Central America.
Okay.
You know, some of them will go to Florida. Any place really where it's warm and there are bugs, then they're going to be fine. But tree swallows also can do diet switching. So when they get to Churchill in May, there's no bugs, but they will eat berries.
Really?
Yes.
Is that unusual in terms of birds, the diet switching?
Well, it's fairly, yes. It's not the majority of birds.
Yeah.
The yellow-rumped warbler can overwinter in the Northeast because it does diet switching. You know, it eats insects in the summer and berries all winter.
Wow. So it's major kind of improvising. It's like, well, here's what's here now, and later the mosquitoes and stuff that we really like will be available, but we got to hang tight and have these berries in the meantime.
Exactly. Exactly right.
See, I kept telling people that these tree swallows were darn interesting, and I didn't even know how interesting they were. So,
and they're cute.
Yeah, they really are. In fact, I managed to get a pretty good picture of you holding one. In fact, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about what happens when you, what we witnessed you do that afternoon. But I'm just going to let people know again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Kathleen Schnarr-Zuvino, a.k.a. Dr. Kit, a professor of biology and ecology at the University of Jamestown, where she oversees the Tree Swallow Project, which we're discussing, that's conducted in both Jamestown and Churchill, Manitoba. Kind of unusual, I guess. By the way, let me just finish this. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So are there any other, at least tree swallow things, that have multiple locations or at least two country locations?
I don't know, Duncan. That's an interesting question.
Yeah. No, I thought that seemed kind of striking about yours. Anyway, so we just got a nice email, but it's as much as nice about the show as it is about you. So it says, you do an amazing job of finding incredibly interesting, well-spoken experts on the animal world. Keep it up. So that's nice. And that's a kudo to you, Dr. Kidd, as much as to Talking Animals. So that's great. So let's, if you would, walk us through so that that afternoon that we saw you, you and one of your students were checking or doing something at a nest box. So maybe just kind of tell us, like, from first arriving, like, what happens and what you're doing in terms of recording data.
Sure. So basically, we band the nestlings on day 11 after hatch. So that's why we have to monitor them to know when the eggs are laid and how long the incubation occurs and when hatch happens. The reason we picked day 11 is because the tree swallows, their legs will get skinnier as they mature. So when they're born, they have fat, short legs, and then on day 11, their legs are going to be about adult size as far as thickness. This is important for when we put the bands on. If we band them too soon, the band will be too tight on their leg, and if we go after day 11, they can fledge as early as day 14, and fledge means fly. If we go after day 11, we may scare them so much that they try to fly prematurely, and they're truly not ready to fly yet.
Yeah.
So we have a very narrow window, and we go on that day, and then what we do is we go to the nest box. As we approach it, the adults, if they're in there, they leave, and we already know if there's four or five or six or seven of the nestlings in the box. Then we take them out and we put them in cloth bags because that keeps them more calm and quiet. When we get them to the very high-tech lab, basically what we do is I band the young on the left leg as a rule, and you know, this way is when I get a recapture and I see that the band's on the left leg, it alerts me to the fact that this bird is a known age bird. Then we weigh the bird, so we know on day 11 this is what the birds weigh, and that's going to give us an indication of how quickly they're maturing and developing, and you know, some sense of their health status. I'm not worried about them getting enough mosquitoes because clearly there's plenty.
Yeah.
But not if it gets cold and not if we have multiple days of rain and high wind. Anything that discourages the insects is going to decrease their food abundance. So after we weigh them and we band them, we put them back into the nest box. And we hurry to get the first one done and back in. We do not want the parents to abandon. And typically, I don't know if you noticed, the parents are on the overhead wire and they're watching everything that we do. And then when we get them all back in, we pull away, and the parents will go back in and continue feeding the young.
So a couple questions that description raises. One is to know if there's 267 boxes, to know exactly which boxes have birds on that'll be those birds day 11. I mean, that must take some serious logistical efforts to track that and know, okay, here's where we got to go today because it's day 11 for this, 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 and this.
Well, and that's why I don't hate computers as much anymore.
I see. I've come around to computers, thankfully. Yeah, I see. Okay, so you're tracking all that through some kind of spreadsheet or some sort of program.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And here's the other thing, because when you talked about the concern about them growing and eating and the kind of weather that can happen in Churchill, so if there was a number of days of bad weather, even though it's a season where it shouldn't be, could the birds go back in terms of the diet switching you described and say, hey, mosquitoes, we can't get any right now. Can we go back to berries? Or is that only like at the beginning and then once they switch, that's what they're eating? That's what they need to eat for the rest of that period?
I don't know that the young could, you know, be fed berries at this point. The adults, so last year, oddly enough, we had a freeze on July 7th, and it wiped out about 40% of our nestlings. They died.
Wow.
But it was this freeze, and it happened in a very localized area. So the nest boxes out east had the highest damage, and the nest boxes closer to town and on Goose Creek Road, they were okay. So that's one thing we noticed. We also noticed that if the adults left, the nestlings died. So some adults just left on July 7th when the storm came in. They left. The adults that stayed, the nestlings survived. So I think that, and that has a lot to do with the thermal regulation. The nestlings really can't keep themselves warm, so they need the adult to keep them warm.
Sure. Well, they need them in the nest with them.
Right.
To keep warm in bouts of weather. Wow. Interesting. So here's the thing, Dr. Kitt, we're sort of in our last couple minutes or so, but I know you're trying to get to, from what you alluded to, like a 5 years, which I guess you're on the cusp of. Well, that'll give you the kind of data that I guess you really need to say, okay, here's what our findings are from a 5-year study.
Yes.
Will the Tree Swallow Project continue beyond that anyway, or will that sort of mark what you really needed to do and there's other projects you may want to pursue?
Nope, this will continue beyond this and into whenever.
Okay.
And the reason being is it was a lot of effort to get these boxes up, and we've cultivated a lot of interest.
Yeah.
Also, as I said, I'm hopeful that if the insectivore population is declining, places like Churchill might be a refugia for these birds.
And also, it looked like, by the way, I should let people know that there's a website that you sent me to that's treeswallowprojects.com. And part of that, I noticed, it really seemed like that the message, among others there, was like, hey, you too could do a tree swallow project. So it seems like you're sort of encouraging citizen scientists in that way. Do I get that message correct? Or
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I also hold workshops for free. You know, I buy the lumber and we cut it. And people can come to these workshops and they can take the nest box they build home with them, or they can leave it to be installed in Churchill, and I send them the GPS coordinates if they do leave it. And it's, I want people to be aware.
Yeah.
You know, education.
Yeah, no, that's great. That seems really cool. And do most people take their boxes, or do most people leave them for you guys to use?
It's 50-50, and
okay.
A lot of it has to do with their luggage. Can they fit it?
Oh, I see.
Carry on?
Okay, it's a practical matter at that point. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, this is cool. Again, I just find the study and tree swallows themselves really, really fascinating, obviously, as do you. So I really appreciate you taking some time today, Dr. Kitt, to fill us in. And we'll stay in touch with you, and especially when we get to the 5-year mark, maybe we'll do a little follow-up after you've kind of had a chance to sift through what that data really does show you after the 5-year mark. So
Well, Duncan, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, this has been Dr. Kit Kath, Dr. Kathleen Schnarr-Zuvino. It is the full proper name. And again, she's at the University of Jamestown. And the website, like I say, where you can find out more in simple layman's terms, thankfully for me, treeswallowprojects.com. And also, if you want to get involved and make your own tree swallow nest box, you can kind of follow those instructions as well there. So thanks again, Dr. Kit.
Thank you, Duncan. Have a great day.
Okay, you too. In a few moments, I'll talk with Dr. Val Beasley, a professor and veterinarian who has deep expertise about the kind of algae in water that was responsible for the deaths of those dogs in recent days in North Carolina, Austin, Georgia, and elsewhere, and steps that dog owners can take to avoid putting their pets at risk. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. I mentioned that our longtime fave, Jim Gaffigan, has a new special out. It's called Quality Time. It's on Amazon Prime as of Friday. I love this piece in particular. It's called Dog Birthday. Brand new from Jim Gaffigan in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Recently, I was invited to a surprise birthday party. It was a surprise birthday party for a dog. That's right. I have friends that are mentally ill. I went. It was in my apartment building, and I needed the material. And to be fair, the dog was surprised. Didn't suspect a thing. Dog didn't know it was his birthday. The dog didn't know it had a birthday. The dog wasn't sure why people were in the apartment. It was the dog's third birthday, which in dog years doesn't matter. Someone made that up, and we just went along with it. Oh, 1 year equals seven for doggies? Okay. When I see a dog, I'll do math. That's not fulfilling some dog need. You know, there's not a dog sitting in a bar right now going, I'm not three, I'm 21. I can legally drink. That's not how dogs keep track of time. If you have a dog, you know they don't keep track of time. You've left your home, forgotten something, walked back in, only to be greeted by your dog like you've just returned from war. These poor dogs. We just attach these points of view on these poor dogs. Like dog is man's best friend. How desperate are humans?
We're best friends, right?
Dog's like, well, aren't we different species?
But we're best friends forever.
You know, you locked me in the house all day with nothing but a bowl of water. You'd think you'd let your best friend sit on the couch.
We're best friends. Now put on this fireman's outfit. We're going to do a photo shoot for Instagram.
You know, sometimes when you sleep, I think about eating your face.
That was Jim Gaffigan with a piece called Dog Birthday, taken from his new Amazon Prime special, Quality Time. Now let's speak to Dr. Beasley about toxic algae in water and how it can protect our dogs from that potentially deadly combination. This is Dr. Val Beasley on Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Dr. Beasley.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for joining me on Talking Animals. So I'm going to guess most folks listening to this show probably are aware that some dogs unfortunately died in recent days as a result of toxic algae in the water at ponds and lakes and other bodies of water. What may not be as clear, including to me, is why that happened. Can you just talk a little about the confluence of factors that led to those deadly results?
Well, these problems happen every year. But they seem to be becoming more common. And the problem is that we haven't done so well in managing nutrients and water bodies. So cyanobacterial blooms or blue-green algal blooms, whichever you'd like to call them, oftentimes produce neurotoxins, things that really are lethal because of neurologic problems, nervous system problems, and also liver toxins. We call them hepatotoxins. And those things are produced oftentimes in warmer weather, in stagnant bodies of water, that have been getting inputs of fertilizer from lawns or from excessive uses in agriculture or from animal feeding operations or poorly managed septic tanks. Also, some air pollution from vehicles and from feedlots, it comes back down, and those add nutrients to water as well. Then we pump the water out or we dam up the stream, and it sits there. And, boy, those are great conditions if you want to have a hazardous blue-green algal or cyanobacterial bloom that could kill a dog.
So the thing I guess I'm not clear on so far, Dr. Beasley, and I'm sure others maybe are in the same boat, is a lot of those things you've described could be and often are the conditions of a certain body of water last year or 6 months ago or whatever. So I guess the question is, was there some further element or catalyst recently that, in addition to those things you described, made those bodies of water, a few different locations across the country, unfortunately, toxic and deadly for those dogs that unfortunately did get in there and have that reaction?
You know, what happens is you get to some sweet spot for the cyanobacteria where the concentrations of nutrients are just right. The competitors are not the other algae or the higher plants that should be in the water, or the plants along the sides aren't there. And so we generally don't know exactly what's going on with the history of the nutrients and the concentrations and the other algae and the other plants in the water. And what happens is that sometimes there's a story, it's picked up by the news and other media pick it up as well. And so the word travels. But these problems occur in lots of places where it never hits the news. And so the problem is that oftentimes the animals die. And sometimes with the neurotoxins, they die before they ever, in fact, often, they die before they ever get to the veterinary hospital.
Yeah.
And with the hepatotoxins, it can be within hours to days. It all depends on the dose. And the animals should be rushed to the veterinary hospital, call ahead, rely on animal poison control centers for additional insights, and treat them because you can definitely increase the probability of their survival and full recovery.
That sounds encouraging. Even to back it up a little bit before that. So let's say, I mean, I'm talking to you from Florida. We experience problems periodically and certainly in the last year, particular ones with algae blooms. So I guess what I'm wondering is there a way for whether people in Florida or anywhere else, again, where this happened with those tragic results, for people to suss out visually that, hey, this doesn't look good, there's this on the surface, or there has been this in recent months, maybe we shouldn't just go in and let the dog go in today or this period of time? I mean, is there anything that simple, or is it because of the things you described, those kinds of bodies of water are always have some inherent risk, and sometimes it's just more severe?
I would tend to lean toward the latter. A lot of times you can see a cyanobacterial bloom, and a lot of times that means it's really most risky.
Yeah.
And it can be a kind of a bright green on the water, or it can be a blue-green or a blue, or it can be red or brown or black. It's not always blue.
Yeah.
And the stuff will splash up on the sides, and you may see some material that starts to turn more blue as it dies along on a rock or a beach. Or you may have dried crusts up on the grass or somewhere around the area if the water's been up high and then it's withdrawn. The dogs will eat the algae up in those crusts. They'll drink the water. They'll lick it off themselves. They'll sometimes eat it off of plants under the water or even when it's resting on the bottom. So you can have an animal poisoned when there's no visible bloom. There's also the risk of leptospirosis from drinking surface water. So it's not a great idea to let dogs swim in any stagnant body of water, or especially when there's any bloom material. But there's some risk there other times as well.
So it sounds like if a body of water just sits, it's a pond, it's something like that, as opposed to one where there's some kind of movement or circulation, the inherent risk is always somewhat significant and sometimes great.
That's right. There have been dogs, a bunch of dogs, poisoned in along rivers, but they're generally slower moving rivers. Blooms can move downstream, and an entire river can be contaminated, sometimes thousands of miles. So you have to be careful about it. You don't generalize and say absolutely no movement, because sometimes a moving stream will also be a big hazard.
Wow. So I guess the key thing is to keep your dog out of almost any kind of body of water, just because even the rule of thumb seems to have enough exception where it's not really a safe rule of thumb.
Yeah, you know, I suppose if it's crystal clear, if it's really gushing along, there's certainly less of a hazard. There's less of a hazard if it looks great than if it looks scummy. But, you know, I'd be very wary about it, just because the toxicoses, the poisoning problems are so severe and so difficult, so lethal a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, unfortunately, the people that had this horrible tragedy happen, I mean, the speed with which it happened was, I mean, it was all horrible and dramatic, but that seemed to be a big part of most of these stories.
Some of these neurotoxins act like nicotine, a huge overdose of nicotine, and nicotine is lethal. Other ones act like an insecticide or a war gas. The difference is they cannot get into the brain as far as we know, but they still can kill by causing respiratory paralysis. And so the animals may drag themselves around. They may have vomiting and diarrhea. It depends on which of these toxins they have. They may salivate a lot. but it's very unforgiving to have an animal exposed to these things. And people lose their beloved pets too often.
Well, I know I'm like extra scared now, but I guess that would just mean I and others will probably be extra cautious, and just even more so than you would ordinarily. I just err on the side of total caution when it comes to letting your dog go into any kind of body of water.
Yeah, we got to be careful. We don't want dogs to get dehydrated during warm weather. We want to take along some tap water and a bowl.
Yeah.
Be sure they have plenty to drink, and then I would keep them away from the water bodies, especially this time of year.
Yeah.
Anytime it's warm. And with climate change, these things are warming up sooner, staying warmer longer. Warmer places are moving north. You know, it's the risks are getting worse in that regard.
Yeah.
We could certainly do a lot better to try to prevent climate change and to have lots of natural vegetation around and avoid getting fertilizer anywhere near a water body that would tend to stimulate a harmful algal bloom.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, lots of things to think about and to try to stave off, and just generally to be very smart about going into anything that even potentially could have this combination of factors in the water that, again, might not be initially recognized visually, but still could be there lurking in the water. So Dr. Beasley, thank you so much for taking the time to fill us in on this, on Talking Animals. I think it's been extremely helpful. I mean, it's scary, but helpful.
Thanks, Duncan. It's good that you're putting the word out.
All right.
This will save some lives. That's the main thing.
For sure. Thanks again for your time. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori with Radioactivity, extending this three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, and news, and more, including the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lillet. Then at 1 p.m., the music kicks back in with the wonderful show Euro Radio, hosted by Paco Morales, flowing into Scott Elliott's wonderful show, the All Souls edition of It's the Music, at 2 p.m. and continue on into the afternoon and evening right here on WMNF and WMNF.org. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there, too. You can also find links to our Instagram page or Twitter feed and more. Please like us, follow us, etc. And this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. NPR News headlines, and then Rob Lori. Thanks.